This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network, and my guest today, a returning guest, a writer that I'm a huge fan of and teacher, Brad Warner. Brad, thanks so much for taking the time to have yet another conversation with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, always a pleasure. So just quickly, for anyone not familiar with Brad's work, Brad Warner is the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen, and numerous other titles, including It Came from Beyond Zen, Don't Be a Jerk, and Hardcore Zen. A Soto Zen teacher, he is also a punk bassist, filmmaker, and popular blogger who leads workshops and retreats around the world. In addition to his books, his writing appears in Lion's Roar, Tricycle, Buddha Dharma, and Alternative Press. He lives in Los Angeles, where he is the founder and lead teacher of the Angel City Zen Center. You can learn more about Brad at www.hardcorezen.info. And again, Brad, I thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you. I did want to preface the show, a note to listeners. Brad's just getting over a cold. It's a cold or a sinus thing, so we're both a little congested. Yeah. You might hear some sniffles or coughs, but that's the way of the human experience. So,
sure is.
Right? So, you know, we're going to talk today, Brad. As I mentioned, you know, I've had you on the show before, and we've had conversations for other programs, and I've always appreciated them. I, like I said, truly am a huge fan of your writing, and the approach you take, it's been very influential in my own writing and work. And this, your latest book, Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen, is no exception. To be honest, I find myself, like, after I finish reading, you know, your most recent book, I'm like, where else is he going to go? You know, like, what else is he going to do?
And that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah. But then you come out with something and it's just as good. And, you know, honestly, anyone who listens to the show knows I don't blow smoke and I don't have people that I'm not interested in speaking with. So this was such a really special book, partly because obviously it's not, I don't know that paying tribute is the right word, but, you know, you're using this thread of losing one of your childhood friends, which you find out about while you're on a tour in another country. And while continuing that tour, you're writing these letters, these unsaid things to your friend who died, and kind of poking and prodding at just the existential nature of being human. And there's so many great quotes, and I don't know, I just absolutely love this book. So there's a section, well, like I mentioned before we hit record, I wanted to read to lay the premise, but I've been talking for a few minutes. Before I do that, was there anything you wanted to jump in and say before I?
No, it's great that you're talking, because with this cold, it makes it hard on my voice to talk too long. But no, it's I'm glad you liked the book, and it really, you said kind of what the premise is, and I, you know, you don't like to brag about your own work, I suppose, but I feel like this is something special in a way that I didn't anticipate when I first started writing the book. So
Sure.
I don't know what it's going to come out like when I wrote it, and I thought it was a good idea, and I started embarking on the writing process. But it was really when I did the audiobook, because there's now an audiobook version as well,
Oh, great.
and so instead of doing a normal audiobook, I was going on the road again to Europe, and I was going to be visiting a lot of the places that are written about in the book. So I decided I'll just read the chapters instead of just doing a normal lecture. I'll read the chapters in the cities in which they were, supposedly written. And
Wow.
I'd never done that with a book before, and I didn't know how that would go over. But the reaction I got from the audiences over there was really, it was kind of surprising, and my own reaction was kind of surprising. I was getting kind of choked up as I read these things in front of audiences. So it's it. So I realized, oh, this is a different sort of book,
Yeah.
and I'm happy to promote it, even almost as if it's something. I don't have as much of an attachment to it now that I've written it and put it out. Now I feel like, oh, this is a good book. I'm going to promote this good book,
Right.
and separate from the fact that I happen to be the one who wrote it. So yeah, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, that's so cool. I had no idea about that audiobook. So now I'm going to have to hit up Kim when we're done and get my hands on that.
Oh, well, the audiobook is published separately, so you'll have
Oh, it
to
is. All right, fine. I'll hit you up and
yeah.
I'm happy to pay in support. All right. I'm going to read. And listeners of the show know that sometimes I'll read excerpts from the books. This is a little bit longer than I typically read, not too long, but I'm like, I'll read this paragraph and this and then, but I just, oh, I need to read, this as I'm going to read it. It's just what
Okay.
feels right. Everyone sit back, relax, it's story time. This is actually right from the second page of the book. So you wrote a little bit leading up to this. You address it right off the beginning, chapter one, carved into the universe, dear Marky, you're dead now, so I don't know if you'll get this letter. And you go on, and I'm skipping parts of that just for time's sake. But where I want to pick up is several paragraphs later, and you're still writing, and it says, "It's 9:40 p.m., but somehow it feels like the middle of the night. Maybe that's because I just got the news that you died last night, or this morning, or something in the very recent past. I've traveled internationally since I was 7 years old, and I can still never work out time zones. Suffice it to say, dead is dead, no matter what time it happened. Cancer. Age 48. Jesus. I'm in Hamburg to talk more about Zen to some other people tomorrow night. Maybe I'll get it together by then, but right now I don't want to talk about fucking Zen. I want to be in Aberdeen, Washington, getting high with you, Marky, on the custom grown weed your neighbor provided to help with your pain, like we did just a month or so ago when you were still alive. Watching stupid videos. I want to be back in Akron at the clubhouse. 20-some years ago, sitting on the bed with you and Lydia, the tattooed lady, eating, I'll need help on this one, Recesi's
Oh,
pizza? Recesi's
Recesi's,
pizza, thanks. Planning world conquest. Oh, the things we were gonna do. When I arrived in Hamburg, maybe an hour ago, I switched on my laptop and an email popped up from Lydia. She said you died a few hours earlier. I don't know what time it was back in the States, but Lydia was still up. We reminisced about the days you and I and she all lived in the clubhouse, that dump in Akron where both our bands practiced. I think we both cried. Maybe that'll make you happy to hear. Everybody wants to imagine that people will cry after they die, right? I'm staying in an apartment of a woman named Johanna, who runs a tiny little Zen center out of her tiny little apartment. She made one of its 2 rooms into a zendo, which is what we Zen nerds call our meditation spaces, and that's where I'm going to be sleeping, if I can sleep tonight. After I got the news of your death, I excused myself and went out to wander the streets of the city. I do that a lot when I'm on these European tours, drifting alone through strange cities, poking through dusty old record shops when I can find them. You spent a lot of time in record stores too when you were alive. The record shops were all closed by the time I got to Hamburg. but I didn't know what else to do. Joanna and her roommate Julia were nice people, but I needed to be myself. You're not even the first person I know who died while I was on this tour. The day I arrived in Stockholm, the first stop on this tour, I got a call from my friend Melissa, who told me her brother Jeremy had passed away suddenly a few nights before. He was 36. At least you lived a few years longer than him, which is something, I guess. What am I doing with my life? That's what I'm thinking as I sit here with my slice of pizza getting cold while I write this letter you'll never get. I'm supposed to be some kind of spiritual master. I write books about it, for God's sake. People ask me questions all the time as if I have the answer for them. I have no answer. I have 30-odd years of looking at my own soul and finding there was nothing there to look at after all. I took a vow to save all beings. I couldn't even save you from being eaten alive by your own guts, and I never told you any of this. Until now, anyway. Now that it's too late to tell you anything. Where are we going? Where do we come from? Why are we here? Does anybody care? I mean, do they? Honestly. I guess your being dead is making me cynical right now. Not that I blame you for that. I've always had a cynical side. I'm skeptical of everything, including myself. Hell, I'm the last person I'd ever believe anything about. What most people call spirituality is bullshit, and yet I've dedicated my life to something most people call spiritual practice. Sometimes I wonder why I even do this, but other times I know exactly why. And, you know, that's like where I had to force myself to stop because, you know, we have to have a conversation here too.
Yeah.
But it's like, I just kind of want to, I want to do my own audio of this book for listeners. Not that I want to take money out of your pocket, but it's just, it's so poignant and beautifully written. And that's something I've truly loved. That's what really caught me when I read Hardcore Zen for the first time was not just the fact that here's someone who is close to me in age and like gets it from the punk aspect, but his writing is incredible. Like you're a writer and not just a teacher, you know, or I don't know which words you like or don't like, but you know, that's a shining example of, you know, how eloquently your prose are written and engaging. So anyways, anything you want to elaborate or just kind of riff on from what I just shared? I know there's a lot in that. But
yeah, excuse me. It's always weird to hear that again, or hear it read by somebody else. It was very personal. It's written in the book, so there's a bit of subterfuge involved in the writing process of this book. In that I mean it's pretty obvious. I didn't actually write these as letters.
Right.
You know, it's a bit of a literary conceit to do it that way. But the one that you read was actually when I was in Hamburg, I was at that pizza shop, as it says, and I had this diary with me and a pen, and I was writing this stuff down. I always keep a little entry for each day because I think it might be useful later on to write about my travels and stuff. So I'll write down the little details.
Right.
And that night I wrote what actually reads like a letter to my friend who had just died. And when I came to put it in the book, I went through several stages. I rewrote it for the book, and then I looked at the rewritten version and I thought, well, this isn't right. So I kind of went back and mostly just retyped what was in that initial diary entry. I had to add a few things and words here and there because there would be bits that a reader wouldn't understand because they're too personal and that kind of thing. But it's pretty raw, and that's pretty much what I wrote to my diary.
Yeah.
You know, but actually as if I was writing to my friend. And the whole as I said, it's a literary conceit to do it this way, but as I wrote each letter, I really did try to be completely honest in the sense that I tried to write exactly as I would write to him. You know, I didn't want to make it just a sort of a fake thing. I tried to sort of fix in my mind this friend of mine who died and put down what I would write to him if I thought he could read it.
Right.
And Honestly, I don't know if he can read it or not.
Yeah.
I'm a bit let's see, I'm a bit of an agnostic when it comes to anything about life after death. I tend to believe the standard Buddhist line about what happens, although that gets very complex and difficult to understand anyway.
Yeah.
But even the standard Buddhist version of what happens after you die, I'm a bit, I take it all with a grain of salt.
Right.
So that's, what you read is real personal to me, even though
Yeah.
it's now out for, however many people buy the book to read. It still feels kind of personal.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you, saying it was cool that I read it before we did, and part of me almost didn't because I can tell how personal it is. But yeah, it's like, that's how you write so raw and candidly, especially in this book. You have a way with, 1 minute, really like hitting that heart and gut in a beautiful way, and then, being a smart ass sarcastic, yet in a playful, lighthearted way. And sometimes not so much, like, and that's another thing I appreciate. Like, you don't pull punches and you speak your truth and share your thoughts without holding back. But super poignant, as I said.
Right.
And one part which you kind of you did just talk about, but in that section, where you say, where are we going? Where do we come from? Why are we here? Does anybody care? I mean, do they? Honestly. So I know you said you for the most part kind of are in line with the Buddhist concepts of something happens, karma, possibly reincarnation, but again, taken with a grain of salt, because who knows? Like, we're alive and we're not dead at the moment. So I'm not traveling the Bardos, and that I know is more Tibetan than Zen, but who knows? But those questions, like, are they ones that as you wrote them, you reflected on maybe while you were reading them out loud for the audio book? I mean, I know those are things you've spent the majority of your life looking at anyways, but are there any new insights or experiences or personal understandings you've had as a result?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have done this practice for 30-odd years, and there is a certain progress, and there's a certain amount of kind of understanding that happens after you do a practice like this for a long, long time. And so, yeah, there, I suppose insights, I mean, every insight, this sounds like cliche, but every insight I have just kind of makes me realize, oh, that's not it.
Right,
You know,
right.
so, so you, you know, you kind of, that's what's happened at various points along the path, is that it's that sometimes you'll be just walking along minding your own business, and then all of a sudden it feels like some kind of great understanding has dawned, and that's probably true to a certain extent. But any of the great sort of moments of understanding I've had have been followed as well by, like, I don't know what the hell that meant. So like the answers of where do we come from, where are we going, and all this, a lot of religions like to posit a very specific answer, especially the really sort of popular religious versions will tell you exactly where we came from and what we're doing here and why we're on this earth and all that. And those answers have never been really very satisfying, because they sort of put limits on things. And I feel like, on the one hand, it's not all just sort of meaningless, and who cares, and we just live and get as much as we can and then die. I don't think it's like that. I think there is a greater meaning and purpose, and there's a direction that things are going and that things want to go, and we can align ourselves with that, and there's a greater cosmic meaning, and I believe all of that. But I also don't think you can ever encompass all that great cosmic meaning into a nice, easy formula, that can be memorized and regurgitated on cue, because that it doesn't work like that. So I feel like the Zen process is the one thing I like about it is it asks a lot of questions, and provides almost no answers to those questions, you know, which I think initially even for me was really frustrating,
right?
Because often teachers will toy with you a little bit because they'll present you with these questions as if there's going to be an answer to them, and right. then after a while you go, oh wait, there aren't any answers to these questions, but the questions themselves help help kind of point you in the right direction. Which I think is real useful. So it's we're not just asking those questions to be, I don't know, to be funny. You know, there is a meaning to asking these questions, but the meaning isn't that okay, dig around and you're going to find out the answer to that question. It doesn't work like that.
Right. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, at least based on my own experience, and that's kind of what I appreciate, like with Zen koans and, you know, these things that they kind of fuck with you, but in a way that, like you said, like, oh, that's not it. And, you know, is there ever an it, you know, and I don't know, maybe there's not an it, and that's the whole point. But, you know, kind of, I don't know, a little bit of a sidetrack, but not really. In relation to what you were saying, on my end, I know you're a big sci-fi fan, and I enjoy sci-fi. I fall a little more into the horror category as far as things I like. But so like the last year or two, I've been completely spent on spiritual literature, quote unquote spiritual literature. And, you know, it's been hard to, I've been having a lot of different guests on my podcast, which has been really refreshing. And I've been reading, this is probably one of maybe the only books that would fall under the, you know, spiritual category I've read in the last year or so. It goes like that for me. I still have a reverence. I still have my bookshelf with a lot of the great mystic texts and, you know, teachings, but I've been reading a lot of like David Wong and
David Wong's great.
Oh yeah,
I really enjoy his writing. Yeah,
he just announced this morning. I don't know, you might not have seen, but his follow up to Futuristic Violence is now officially available for pre order. Comes out in October. Can't wait. Love his.
Yeah,
he's
interesting, and even the movie version they did of was it John Dies? Yeah, again. I thought they did a good job of it.
Absolutely, and Paul Giamatti, you can't go wrong. So, I love that. But I'm mentioning that because, like, even in reading like stuff like his or Grady Hendrix, or especially someone that I've recently been really into, Jeremy Robert Johnson, who wrote Entropy and Bloom and also Skullcrack City. And what kind of caught my eyes, David Wong had endorsed a bunch of his stuff, as had Chuck Palahniuk. And in Entropy of Bloom, it's a book of short stories. And one of them is called The Oarsman. And you just made me think of it as you were talking about a bit about your practice and learning and, you know, people that have expectations when they step onto a path. You didn't mention that, but I'm kind of throwing that in there. And one of the stories is called The Oarsman. And at the end of his book, what I appreciate, and I just coincidentally have it sitting in a stack of books as we're talking, so I just grabbed it. But at the end, he writes a little bit about each story. And I'm sharing this because I think it helps talk a little bit about personal experience with tradition. So anyways, The Oarsman, he wrote, "There was a stretch of time where my wife would read books about Buddhism aloud just before we'd pass out for the night. Some nights I'd find the ideas compelling and comforting. Other nights, when the focus would be ego death and universal oneness, I found myself sweating, tossing and turning, filled with existential dread. It led to me thinking about the idea of weaponized empathy and what kind of people might be left once that weapon had worked."
This, weaponized empathy.
the story is out of control. Yeah, it's like these monks, like, just creating, they're like, you know, I don't know, meditating and like creating this crazy laser that comes down and like, I know that's his style of writing. But it's cool because in these writings of like Wong and Johnson and others like them, there is a lot of esoteric and, you know, very meaningful insight that underlies a lot of it. So Where was I going with all of that? Anyways, I don't know.
I think there's a lot you can do with in a work of fiction. This is why I really, I was going to say Rick and Morty, because I loved the first two seasons, and then I just had a chance to watch the recent ones, and I'm going, oh, they're not quite doing what they used to do on this show anymore. But you can get into these philosophical ideas from another direction, and sometimes I set out to be a fiction writer, really, and my fiction still hasn't gotten. I've self-published. Well, no, one of my fictional books did get published by a real publisher, but mostly people only know the nonfiction Buddhist stuff, and I find there's a bit of a limitation when you're doing that, because there's an expectation if you're writing a nonfiction, especially a Buddhist thing, that the audience sort of expects that you have the answer, or at least a religiously supported answer or belief system. You know, that's part of your religion that you're going to present to them, the audience.
Right.
And I don't think the great works of Buddhist literature are not like that. And that's why I find Buddhism is this kind of funny thing that gets slotted into the category of religion, because sometime in the 19th century or 18th century, there were these people who decided that's where it belonged, and it's stayed there ever since. But I do think certain kinds of Buddhism are religious, but Zen Buddhism isn't.
Right.
And so a work of Zen Buddhism is, it's like existentialist or something in that sense. There's a lot of things that are very similar to existentialism in Buddhism. The one thing that makes it real different is it has a practice. Right. Buddhists have a practice, which the meditation practice, Zazen, right. And we have rituals that we kind of more or less agree upon as part of this practice, which makes it look like a religion. But I think the approach is very different from a religion. It's not there to give you an answer. It's to provide you with a set of, God, it sounds like such a cliche, but I'm going to say it, a set of tools with which to explore the questions that it presents you with, which I think is what makes it a little better than any form of Western philosophy I know. Because the Western philosophy, like the existentialists and others, are also good at formulating interesting questions, but they don't give you much of anything to work with, how to deal with those questions or an approach. And what Zen provides is this physical approach to dealing with these questions, which I think most of us in the West would never even think that there could be a physical approach to responding to philosophical questions. And by the physical approach, I mean the meditation practice, which is actually a physical exercise. And it's an exercise in which you don't move, but it's still everything else about Zazen, other than the fact that you're not moving, is exactly like an exercise. It's exactly like anything you'd go to the gym and do, because you're doing it very deliberately in a physical way.
Right.
But you are using that state that comes from the exercise as a way to penetrate into these deeper questions. And I don't think you can penetrate into these deeper questions without doing something like that. I mean, you can sit and think about the questions, but thinking will only take you so far. Right. And the Zen practice gives you this physical thing to do, which can take you farther than thinking can.
Right.
Which I think most of us in the West wouldn't even, we'd be like, what? You can get into a physical, you can get into a philosophical question in a physical way, and I think that would just be baffling.
Right.
Which it is. When I first came across it, I was just like, what? but I did it for a while. I'm going, oh yeah, this helps penetrate into that question by sitting with it and not thinking about it.
Right.
that's interesting.
And I love that. And it's like you said, I don't know where it was. I know I read it, but it's something like you've spent so many years like looking into, I don't think you use the word soul, maybe you did, but only to find nothing there. And it's just a very interesting thing that the deeper we go, it's, I'll be the cliche now, the onion, you know, example, peeling away the layers over and over. But that's another thing I love about your writing, not just in this book, but others, is, you know, the fact that you write in such a way that, aside from being raw and honest and, you know, like saying, I laughed when you said, I'm the last person I would trust to have any of the answers. Like, I feel the same way writing my own books or when I do my own workshops. And I say that, I'm like, don't believe a word I say, you know, find out for yourself, a very, you know, Buddhist thing to say. But I really love the fact that you also, you know, you used to write for like Suicide Girls, as did I, and you write for Alternative Press. And recently I've been writing for Revolver magazine and Fangoria.
Fangoria.
Yeah. Like that's.
Now I'm jealous.
I childhood Chris is, you know, like jumping in joy over that one. But it's like, I don't know how or why, but they like are letting me like use horror threads and, but bringing in these like, you know, otherwise I'm so spent on the word spiritual, but for lack of a better word, like spiritual ideas, but using, you know, horror as a theme to explore them. And I love the fact that I'm able to do that. And I love the fact that like you bring that into your writing as well. And that's another one of the reasons I fell in love with your stuff is like, oh man, he's a nerd just like me. And he actually like wants to know what's going on, which I think is a big part of just what happens when you get into punk or hardcore. You know, most of us get involved in that because we're looking for something deeper than what is offered at face value. And then you grow up, and I still love punk and hardcore, and I'm still in bands, and I still meditate, and I'm still, you know, just doing what I can do. So Alternative Press, is that something you're still currently doing, or
I haven't been in contact with those guys for years, but that was a kind of a funny situation, because Alternative Press, back when Zero Defects, the hardcore band I was in, well, I'm back in the band now because we got together about 10 years ago.
Right.
And we used to hang out with those guys. That was based in Cleveland, and we were based in Akron, which is like 30 miles away. So, you know, I would see the Alternative Press guys before Alternative Press was one of these little Xerox zines that came out initially before they, you know, got on slick paper and went nationwide. So I remember Alternative Press being something that they would print up at the local Kinko's and pass out at the punk shows. So, it's been interesting, but no, I haven't written for them for a while. Although I kind of agree with you on the spiritual book side. I feel like it's kind of funny because I write in this genre, and this is, you know, the section where you find my books is the section where all the spiritual books are. But most of what sits next to my books on the shelves are, I wouldn't even consider picking up. I mean, and which is not to disparage all of it. I mean, some of it's probably really good, but it's just not something I'm that interested in. I mean, partly for me because it seems like work, you know, when I see a book like that, and partly because, you know, a lot of them are written at this sort of intro level, because that's where most people are at with this stuff anyway. Right. So, you know, something that might be a great, great read for somebody who's just getting into Buddhism or spirituality in general. For me, it's a perfectly good book, but I'm not going to read it, you know, because I don't need to read that. So I have a lot of interest in presenting it in different ways, you know, that's to me what the big tragedy is, that a lot of people who could use this sort of approach are not going to ever get it. And this is partly what Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen is about.
Yeah.
Because the guy I'm writing to, his real name wasn't Marky, but, you know, we call him Marky in the book.
Sure.
The Marky person that I'm writing to, he was a guy, I mean, he was a real person who I knew a lot and I was close to, and he knew that I meditated, but I never made a big deal out of it. And he would have been a great example of one of the many people I've known in my life who I think could have benefited greatly from this sort of practice, but I can't even imagine him trying it out,
right?
Because that would be so alien to, you know, to the way he was raised and how he thinks about things and all that, and it would just seem like this goofy religion that Brad got into, you know,
right.
Probably as far as he was concerned. I don't know what he really thought of it, but you know, just to get into something religious, that just wouldn't, because you look at religion, you're like, oh, that's a bunch of garbage. I'm not going to get into that.
Right.
And I actually don't, that's the approach I took to religion in my youth. And these days I kind of look at it, even people who are conventionally religious, and go, okay, I understand that. I mean, I'm not going to, like I say, Zen is an unconventional religion, if it's a religion at all. But people who go into conventional religions, sometimes they're going into it for, you know, exactly the same reasons that I got into Zen. It's just that, you know, this is the approach they prefer, and I think that it's valid. But there's a lot of us who really need something,
yeah.
And we're never going to find it. I was just looking at somebody on Twitter ranting about, you know, how it was a person who considers herself a materialist. You know, she says this in her tweets all the time, and does not, even though she's very smart and she's an academic, does not understand why people would get into religion. And I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. Cause if you're from that mindset, you look at religious people and you go, oh, they're just wacky, delusional people.
Sure.
But there's a reason that religion has persisted throughout time, through every human culture.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's just because we're all just, you know, wishful thinkers. I think that there's something real that religion is attempting to address, and sometimes it doesn't address it very well,
right.
You know, and often it gets kind of usurped,
right,
by people who realize the power that's, you know, available to you if you are seen as a religious leader.
Right.
So, you know, and it easily devolves into something terrible. But that doesn't mean that at the core, there's, you know, a lot of people assume that okay, that because of that, at the core, there's nothing valuable in religion. And I might have gone that way too, you know,
right,
because of the way I grew up and what I saw and the abuses I saw of religion around me. You know, I could easily have gone that way and been totally cynical about it. But somehow, you know, I lucked out. You know, I met this teacher of Zen who had exactly the right sort of approach that made it available to me. And so I think, oh, maybe I can be that to other people. I can kind of provide an in, but I'm not, you know, a way that they can frame it to themselves and go, okay, maybe I can look into this thing.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah. So well said. And, you know, I completely understand what you're saying about seeing your books in the bookstore, like next to books that you normally otherwise wouldn't read. Same happens to me when I see mine. And I think we're just going to need to get the literary, I don't know, Barnes and Noble's is the last major one that I'm aware of. But, you know, create a new section. Come on. Like, I got very lucky in that my last book was in the philosophy section. I don't know how that happened, but that was a lot nicer than the self-improvement, because same.
No,
you know,
yeah. Every once in a while I'll walk into a bookstore and they have my books shelved in the music section, which I find,
okay,
you know, this has happened a handful of times and I never move them. I think, oh, that's good. That's,
yeah,
you know. It's and I think that's funny. I guess it's because of the covers and the fact that I, you know, I do play in a band, so
right,
maybe the people who are shelving the things assume that this is about my work in the band. And sometimes they're about both. So you
yeah,
know,
absolutely.
But I think that's, you know, I'm so happy when they're in the wrong section, because
yes.
When they're in the right section, nobody will find them anyway.
And that's the point. And that's why, like you said, like you and I think take a very similar approach in the sense that there, you nailed it. There are so many people, like, for example, your friend, Marky, the alias in the book,
mm-hmm,
who potentially could have benefited from this, but when presented as it, you know, is in a popular format, these books we're mentioning without names, I'm sure listeners probably already know many of them or whatever. But there are so many people that are jaded or feel disenfranchised or skeptical toward the idea. And they certainly could benefit from it. And, you know, one of the new books I'm working on, I'm co-writing with the head staff writer at Fangoria, and it's a nonfiction, but it's, you know, trying to, it's our attempt to reach that demographic with some of these ideas and methods and practices that.
Actually, that's a great idea. I mean, horror movies traditionally have had a lot of, there's a lot of connection between horror and religion.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I got lucky in the sense that you know, since Fangoria rebooted, the editor in chief over there, what is it, editor in chief? I think so. Anyways, he's open to that idea and he sees the connection. And the head writer that I've become good friends with, that I'm working on this book with, also, like, you know, he has a, I don't know, some high degree in not therapy, I'm drawing blanks. It's my head cold. I'm sorry. I'm blaming it on that. But he has all these degrees and whatnot. Uh-huh. And he knows the value in that too. And absolutely, like, that's why I've always loved horror movies, is not just because they're fun. There's so much, like, connection there.
I got into science fiction for the same reason. Right, the science fiction that I like is the really philosophical stuff, like Philip K. Dick. You know, I think that's the first place I read about Zen, although I later realized that Philip K. Dick didn't know anything about Zen, but he would always sort of present these ideas that he'd gotten out of Zen books, which I don't think he ever really understood very well. But the fact that he was presenting these ideas was really interesting and valuable to me. So that was a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you know gets your foot in the door, I suppose, and that's what helps. Then awesome. And I think Philip Dick, he's still a great writer, or was. But I still love reading his stuff. And but anyways, man, we've kind of nerded out on a lot, except for your book, though. I know we've been tying that in, but I want to bring it back to the book. So I mean, there's so much that you cover, of course, in the book. And what I love is a lot of it are concepts that you may have talked about in the past. Some of them are ones that I at least don't recall you talking about, but it's through a completely different lens and a different format. And so let's talk about, like, something, one of your letters, the Akron Book of the Dead. Can you talk a little bit about that, that chapter, and you know, 'cause the Tibetan Book of the Dead is.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what I wrote in that. I mean, obviously, it's been a while since I read the book, even the audiobook version. But the idea is, the Akron Book of the Dead was just a kind of play on that we'd both grown up in and around Akron, Ohio. Right. And he was dead.
Right.
And so this kind of question of death and what happens after you die and what it means, this is a big deal in Buddhism. Occasionally, I think it's a little bit too big of a deal with certain people in the Buddhist stream, but it's definitely important and significant. But, you know, I said this earlier, whereas most religions will give you an answer, here's what happens after you die, the Buddhists really don't. I mean, people are sort of familiar with the Tibetan Buddhism, which does have a kind of a structured, you know, they have the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is supposed to tell you all the stages that one goes through after death. In the Zen tradition, that sort of teaching kind of exists in the background, but it's very rarely brought forward. Like in Dogen's writings, Dogen being the guy that I mostly study in terms of Zen philosophy, right. You know, he wrote an incredible amount of stuff, and there's only one small chapter I know of in which he gets into anything like what happens after you die. And even when he gets into it, he kind of comes at it in this tangential way where he uses the stories, which are basically the same sort of stories that you'd find in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, to emphasize how important it is to remain dedicated to your practice, to your meditation practice. You know, he's basically telling you to remain dedicated to your meditation practice even after you go through the fifth bardo, after you die, and all this stuff. And he never tells you that this is what you ought to believe about what happens after you die, because that's all speculative. And in fact, he contradicts you know, that stuff all the time. In other pieces of writing, he'll tell you firewood becomes ash and it never becomes firewood again. Similarly, people, after they die, don't return to life again. So he has that quote, you know, which is hard to reconcile with this idea of the, you know, these bardos and things happening after you die. So I just tried to kind of address that. And I really actually, initially, when I came across that sort of teaching, it confused me. And I was pretty young when I started. I was in my late teens, early 20s when I started practicing this stuff. And I suppose I had hoped at that time that somebody could give me an answer, because there was some stuff going on in my family. There's this genetic condition that runs in my family that two of my aunts had died from, and that my mother was starting to show symptoms of even at that point. And I thought, oh, geez, I better get it together and find out what happens after you die. So I sort of hoped that somebody would say, well, what happens after you die is A, B, C, and D. Right. And I realized that after reading dozens of answers to that question that were framed in more or less that way, that none of them worked. Like none of them, you know. Right. I always hoped to come across the magic one that I could believe, and I still haven't. And that includes the Buddhist versions too. I can't sit there and just believe them. But at the same time, that approach, it's an approach that's at once skeptical and not exactly cynical, you know. Right. like we don't necessarily believe this stuff, but you're willing to try it on for size and go, okay, maybe this has, you know, has something, some indication to where I need to go. But in the end, one of Dogen's best phrases about that is, at the time of dying, there is nothing but death, and at the time of being alive, there is nothing but being alive.
Right.
And so you go, okay, well then, for the time being, here I am alive. Let's think about that, or not even think about that. Let's fully experience being alive in all of its aspects, and then, you know, eventually I'm going to die, and all I can really do about that is, you know, try to delay it as much as possible and try to stay healthy, but it's inevitable no matter what I do, so I might as well just leave it, you know, leave it till later.
Right.
You know, I'll deal with that when I deal with it, because there's nothing else you can do. You know, it'd be like anything. I could plan out how I'm going to open, I'm just trying to think of a random thing, how I'm going to open my front gate and go get my mail later on.
Right.
You know, and I could plan that in intimate detail and everything else. But until I actually go and do it, well, you know, that it's just ideas,
right,
you know, in my mind. And those ideas might have some use, but once I kind of figured out the basic direction I want to go, then I, you know, I might as well just have fun, you know, doing something else, because it doesn't make any sense to obsess about it. So I can't remember exactly what I wrote in that chapter, but I think that was the sort of approach I'm taking.
It was, and that's great. And I apologize, because I should have like read a little excerpt or something.
Oh, but fine.
That you summed it up very nicely. This one, I'm sure you will remember, or I shouldn't say sure, but I'm guessing. And but no, it's something that I thought would be a good part or a good topic for this conversation, because it's something that's constantly coming up and has been since the dawn of, you know, any kind of teacher-student relationship. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's towards the end of your book, you have a chapter, Crazy Wisdom is Usually More Crazy Than Wise.
Yeah.
And now, what I found interesting is you use the example of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and you write almost what I would write about him, and down to the point where I still absolutely love the book Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism.
Yeah.
It's a book I try to read once a year because it just, you know, I don't know, kind of puts myself back in check in a way. Yet on the other hand, for those who aren't familiar, you know, Trungpa Rinpoche was kind of in a way out of his mind, just this loose cannon. And as many others, you know, like recently Netflix has done these tremendous documentaries on Osho and Bikram.
Oh, I saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, the Osho one was, I thought, fantastic. I don't know if you saw the Bikram one.
I saw both of them, yeah.
Yeah, and he, besides that, so y'all, Rinpoche and Alan Watts had his moments. And this is not just to say in Buddhist, because of course it crosses the board, Thomas Merton and the mystic Christian traditions. And I mean, a lot of people, you know, we're human beings. And that's why that student-teacher relationship can be so dangerous. And, you know, more recently, a lot of people that read our stuff, obviously, the stuff with Noah that's happened. And, you know, not that we need to address any of that, but in general, you know, I would love for you to talk a little bit, if you're up for that, about, you know, I guess having that discernment between the teachings and the teacher, and how to protect oneself.
It's such a tricky subject, because you don't want to, I don't want to say the wrong thing and give people encouragement to kind of just go along with a bad situation, because a lot of times that people find themselves in this situation with this, you know, a so-called spiritual teacher, in which there's abuse going on, and you really got to get out of that. At the same time, I think there is, you know, it's like separating the artist from the art, and you don't. You can find a lot of genuine, good and useful teachings coming out of people who themselves may not always embody the best of those teachings. Right. That would be kind of a diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that the teachings themselves are the problem. I mean, they might be, you know, it depends on the actual case. But I mean, there's a reason Buddhism has persisted for 2,500 years. It's shown itself to be resilient even in the face of people who take it and kind of abuse it in certain ways. And I don't know, because it all comes through people. So, you know, anything you receive from your teacher is now yours. You know, it's not dependent upon that teacher. It's not this magic thing that comes from, you know, that person to you. It's something that you are both endeavoring to discover, that exists beyond both the teacher and the student. And the only thing the teacher has is that she or he has worked on it longer than you have. That's usually, you know, about all there is to it. And maybe in working on it longer, they've become able to reflect it a little better, or to express it a little bit more clearly. But that doesn't mean that it's made them a perfect person. So you just have to kind of go with that and sort of hope for the best. And I do think the relationship, especially in the Zen stream, from between teacher and student, ought to be a little dangerous, you know. It's not exactly, and that this is one of the beefs I have with the way it's sort of going in America, is they want to set up all these sort of protection things, you know, rules and stuff to protect the student and all of that, and sort of treat it almost like psychiatry. And I think psychiatry is great where it, you know, where it goes. But Zen is supposed to go a little deeper than that. And in order to go deeper than that, a certain amount of risk is necessary. And so, you know, it's always a, like I say, a tricky situation. You have to decide at every moment how much risk you're willing to put up with. In your practice, and whether the person that you are training with is treating you fairly and honestly or not. Right. You know, if you are a case where you were definitely being exploited, well, that's not good, and you probably ought to get out of that situation. But there are times when I know that my relationship with my teachers got into areas that were like, this is a bit, you know, dodgy, as the British say, and I have to decide, do I want to do I want to carry on with this and, you know, risk getting hurt, right, or whatever it is, or not. And in my case, I was lucky that I had two teachers who were very sincere and who did not exploit their students or do anything like that. But, you know, it's so tricky. I could probably go on and on, because there's a certain amount of exploitation that goes on of teachers by their students. And then that never gets, you know, people love the stories where the teacher is just the bad guy and does all the exploiting of the students. But every story that I've come across, there's always been at least some element of the students doing some of the exploitation too.
Absolutely.
And nobody wants to own up to that. And in fact, whenever I've brought it up, people just scream and holler and go, "You're blaming the victim." I'm going, "No, I'm not blaming the victim. I'm just saying that these are, you know, there's a complex interaction going on. And if you're only looking at one side of that interaction, you're not going to understand it."
Yeah. No, and that's so true. And I know, like, that's why I didn't touch what's recently been happening with, you know, the Noah. And
yeah,
'cause I don't know. I wasn't there, and everyone has their opinion. And, you know, it is what it is, and it's unfortunate for everyone involved. But I don't know. And people would message me and say, "Hey, what's going on?" And I don't know. I wasn't there.
That's all I can say about it. And this is probably similar to you, is that people expect me to know what's going on with Noah Levine. And, you know, they assume, "Oh, you must be friends and hang out or something." But that's not the case. I've met him, like, you know, I don't know, two or three times, never had a conversation with the guy. So I can't say what really happened.
Right.
All I can say is, well, something must have happened, because everybody's pretty upset.
Right. But yes. And investigations. You
know, what that was, I don't know.
Right. Right. And same here. Like, I think I met him once in 2005. And I can say that through the email interactions we've had, he was always very pleasant. And, you know, I have certainly, his books helped me early on in my journey. But yeah, it's like people just assume same thing, like, "Oh, you guys are kind of punk rock and you write about this from this kind of perspective." But no, like, you know, just you and I have never met in person, though we've had several conversations. But God forbid something like that happened to you or I. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there's such a kind of a rush to judgment, too. And I think, well, the people who were involved in that, they have their own feelings about it, and they're going to deal with those feelings as they deal with them. And it's not really my place. You know, a lot of times there was another teacher who got involved in some scandals and stuff. And I've talked to some of his students who say, "Well, yeah, I was, you know, I probably would be considered a victim of his exploitation, but it didn't feel like I was a victim of his exploitation at all to me."
Right.
And they resent everything being characterized as, you know, exploitation, because that invalidates the work that they did with this person. So, you know, that's why I don't want to rush in and judge all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to clarify, Noah is only coming up because he's one of the more recent cases. But the point of me bringing that up had nothing to do with Noah per se, but just the safety of students and the relationship with teacher. And I'm glad you made that point about also students, you know, sometimes not victim shaming in any, or you know, not victim shaming. Now I'm trying to like be very cautious with my words, but it's such a goddamn tricky thing. But I agree with you that, you know, there are other sides to the story and other scenarios and ways in which it can be interpreted or experienced. So I know that is the diplomatic kind of way to go about it, but it's also, I think, the only fair way, unless you, like I said, were directly there and know exactly what happened. So that's not how I want to end the conversation. So you know, and there's so much more in your book, but again, I do think that was at least worth a portion of the conversation. So, you know, something you'd wrote in the book is that it's just a short line, and I appreciate that you wrote, "I'm not all that interested in Buddhism. I'm much more interested in what truth is, or what is true." And maybe that's a good place to end, because We call ourselves whatever we want or don't want, and that's fine. It's just words and labels, and but I love that sentiment. So I, maybe if we can end on you just sharing some thoughts about that. I mean, to end on a light topic,
Yeah, I never. I remember early on, my first teacher, Tim, told me, if somebody put a gun to my head and said, "What religion are you?" I'd probably tell him a Buddhist, but otherwise I don't announce myself as a Buddhist. And this is a guy who'd been dedicated to Buddhism since he was 15 or 12 years old, I think. He was really young when he started.
Right.
So it was really significant to him. And that's kind of how I feel about it, too. I feel like obviously I'm a Buddhist, if you really want to go there, but I'm not sitting there. It's not that I'm dedicated to Buddhism. I just find Buddhism to be a really, really useful way to get at the things that I'm really interested in. Yeah. I'm really interested in what's the truth about reality and how to have an ethical life and how to do things that are going to promote humanity and help humanity sustain itself over the long run, because I think it's important that we do sustain ourselves over the long run. I'm not one of these misanthropes who thinks that the world would be better off if humans just died. I think the world will be better off if humans can get their stuff together and do it right and remain as part of the ecosystem that we're in. But Buddhism I just find as a useful way to get into that. And Buddhism is an unfortunate word because we usually understand those isms to mean that's what you worship. So right. A Buddhist must worship Buddha. But my teacher always said, we don't worship Buddha. We our object of worship in Buddhism is reality. And Buddha was just a guy who was very good at coming up with a way to look at reality in all of its aspects. And the great thing about Buddhism is it's in a way I always kind of think of Buddha as being, sort of Einstein in a sense. Einstein came up with the theory of relativity and a lot of ideas of physics that were hugely influential and important, but no scientist worth their salt would ever say, okay, we're just going to freeze the words of Einstein and just stick with those forever.
Right.
He was the guy who set the ball in motion for a lot of the things that we understand and keep exploring in science. But we can say, well, so Einstein might have been wrong, about certain things. Of course, if you're going to challenge Einstein, you better be prepared to back right. up your challenges. And that's the way I feel about Buddha in his role in Buddhism. He set the ball rolling and he put a lot of things into motion that were very important. Now, maybe Buddha was wrong about certain things, or maybe he made some mistakes. But at the same time, he's such a sort of giant in the field that if you're going to accuse Buddha of having made mistakes or being wrong, you better be prepared to back it up the same way a scientist would have to really make a strong case for saying that Einstein was wrong. But at the same time, it's not that we worship this guy Buddha. He was the guy who kind of gave us a framework for looking at these things, and that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the framework that Buddha provided for looking at these things, and I'm interested in trying to do exactly what he did with it, which is, to honestly pay attention and try to see how to work with what we're given in life. And so in that sense, I'm not that interested in Buddhism as much as I'm interested in the truth that Buddhism is addressing.
I love that. And so, we're just over an hour here and I have to wrap this up, but I did want to read just very briefly, just from the back jacket, because we talked a lot about what is in the book and there's so much more that we didn't get to because, I'll take the hit on this one, just nerding out on stuff, which it's, I don't know, I enjoy doing that because it gets tiring talking about the same thing over and over, but
it does.
For the audience, just a quick kind of overview of the book, just to be very clear on what you can expect from it. aside from what we've discussed in this conversation, which, again, the name of the book is Letters to a Dead Friend about Zen, by, of course, Brad Warner. And it's published by your longtime publisher, New World Library. And the back just reads, the night Brad Warner learns that his childhood friend Marky has died, Warner is about to speak to a group of Zen students in Hamburg, Germany. It's the last thing he feels like doing. What he wants to do instead is to tell his friend everything he never said, to explain Zen and what he does for a living and why he spends his time sitting, meditating my life away as it all passes by, lighting candles and incense, bowing to nothing. So as he continues his teaching tour through Europe, he writes to his friend, all the things he wishes he had said. Simply and humorously, he reflects on why Zen provided him a lifetime in a difficult world, or a lifeline in a difficult world. He explores grief, attachment, and the afterlife, and then proceeds to poke and prod at the truth. The result for readers is a singular and winning meditation on Zen, and a unique tribute to both a life lost and the one Warner has found. Wow, usually I'm much more eloquent in my speaking and reading, but anyways, that is, I think that's a very succinct and apropos summary of the book. One that I don't know if this conversation did justice to truly how special it is, but I hope if nothing else, it piqued the curiosity of listeners enough to pick it up and read it. Like I said, for listeners, I haven't read a lot of spiritual material recently, but this is a book that it's a very accessible and engaging, entertaining, and insightful read that I can't recommend enough. If you're checking this out on the Be Here Now webpage, our Be Here Now Network webpage, just scroll down. The link to both Brad's website and the book are there. Brad has a very active YouTube page as well. What's the just YouTube and search Brad Warner? Or do you have a
URL? I think that's the best way. I believe it's like YouTube/hardcore Zen. Okay. I finally set that up. Cool. But I'm a little reluctant to say that because I'm not absolutely sure. But yeah, I've put up so many. The YouTube channel is really fun. I kind of think, well, maybe I should do something more with it. I just sit in front of my bookshelf and talk about stuff and put up a video every couple of days.
But I love it.
It's a good way to communicate. You kind of get a different feel than you'd get from a piece of writing.
Yes, so. Absolutely. And you get to see like you and you just being you. And it's so I recommend that. So we'll make sure that that's linked as well to the show notes. So Brad, thank you so much for writing yet another incredible book, for your time with getting over a cold. And, I hope this book just continues to get in the hands of as many readers as possible.
Well, thanks.
All right. Have a good one. And until next time.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.